So I get to bring up the rear, but I have some storytelling, which I feel very fortunate to be able to do. The previous speaker made reference to a couple of national groups that have been working together to move PSC out into the world where we're reaching people. And the group that's been working really hard, in addition to Andy's evaluation toolkit, is the SNAP-Ed Toolkit group. SNAP-Ed Toolkit put out a call for proposals last May for evidence-based interventions in the policy systems and environmental change realm. All of those RFPs received peer review and are coming together in the Toolkit Second Edition, which will be released in just a few weeks, I think. So, what I decided to do was just give a little snippet. This is my non-disclosure. I have no financial relationships to disclose. Oops. To talk a little bit about those stories from the new toolkit. And I decided to pull a sample, just to give you a cliff note version of a sample from each of the different seven FNS regions. So, I see a lot of familiar faces in the room. I see North Carolina, I see Colorado, I see Maine, I see Kentucky, I see Michigan. I may not have picked your program, I'm sorry, but I just wanted to give you an idea, because the toolkit, the idea and the inspiration is that it's going to grow and build and become a really robust source of inspiration. But those of you who came in at the tail end of the last session where Robert Wood Johnson Foundation was hosting or moderating the session on what's the future, what's public health going to look like in the future, you heard about a new lens that panel was seeing, and it's a lens of local relevance, much different than a top-down approach. And it got me thinking a little bit about some of these examples that I'm going to share and how they all can be applied with that different local lens to make them work no matter where you are. So hopefully you'll find these seven stories inspiring, and I'm going to go really quickly for time, but I think you'll be able to read more about them in the toolkit when it comes out. So that's my teaser for that. I did set this up so that you could see, not reading from the slides, but you could see some of the triad of comprehensive approaches that these samples gave. They're evidence-based strategies. They have a re-aim framework, which I reordered to reach adoption, implementation, effectiveness, and maintenance, because that's really sort of an order of precedence in the programming. They're multi-tiered or multi-sphered. And they're reaching people where they live, learn, work, play, eat, and shop. So that said, I'm starting with the Southeast region. And this is an example from a nonprofit implementing agency in Georgia called Health Empowers. Health Empowers began doing their work in a traditional school setting. But what they've done with that base is what's unique and what gives them an evidence-based PSE emerging practice, I would say. They began with just service delivery, somewhat traditional, but a real focus on physical activity, which was novel for a SNAP-Ed. And they started seeing improved school environments. They started seeing improved behavior. They started seeing improved health outcomes. And now that they're about 4 years in, they really are recognizing that that presence has allowed them to become part of some real change in some of these schools. Keep in mind that especially in rural America, the school is actually a community identity. So it is really remains an ideal place to center some PSE interventions because they have the channel of the school and education and then some. They've been following some of their impact, and they're seeing that schools are seeing policy change, they're seeing systems change, and they're seeing schools moving toward progress in environmental change. They're in 80 schools in North Georgia, and their reach, student reach, is 45,000. They're not just programming in these schools, they're partnering with these schools. And especially inspiring for me, because I do sit on a local school board, is they tell the story of Healthy Savannah. Healthy Savannah reached out to Health Empowers and asked them to work within the community of Savannah, Georgia, to pass school board policy that was voted into policy school design guidelines to make schools a place where it's safe to walk and bike to school every day. That's almost Big P policy, right? So then we'll go up to the Mid-Atlantic, and I'm going to give an example that actually pulls some social media into the picture, because it is 2015, almost 2016 after all. Text to Be Healthy comes out of Maryland, and it is an opt-in voluntary text messaging program that pulls the community into the school. They highlight local events, partnerships, they're connecting schools with the community, parks, grocery stores. I'm just going to read you a couple examples of their messaging so you could really get an idea of what kinds of things they're able to do to connect with community. Take the family to Chancellor's Park Run this Sunday for the Health and Fitness Expo, 10 to 3. Lots of healthy eating tips and fun ways to get moving. Kids are out of school today. Let them cool off while playing water games. Try a water balloon toss, running through the sprinkler, or water bottle squirt tag. So they're really able to stay relevant, timely, and get those messages from whatever intervention, whatever part of the community out. They have a great retention rate with the parents that do opt in for this text messaging. 90% of them have stayed on board for the text messaging service. So they've got really robust partnerships with the schools, the retailers, the physical activity venues, and the community groups. So, an example out of the Mid-Atlantic. Go up to the Northeast. Northeast has New York State Farm to Preschool. That's really added an extensive PSE element to their programming. They're connected within the Child and Adult Care Food Program. So they began an example of multiple programs, public programs, leveraging each other's strengths and successes. They take an environmental approach to the increase of fruits and consumption of fruits and vegetables, and they have just a really comprehensive suite of things that they're doing in these 21 schools, childcare-based farmers markets and CSAs, direct incentives that are coming out of community funding, nutrition ed throughout the community, and then gardens at the preschools. So they have really, really done really good work with Farm to Preschool, building on some really sound partnerships, and that gives it sustainability, right? I'm going to move on to the Midwest to talk a little bit about Michigan Harvest of the Month, which started by another state SNAP Ed program's inspiration within Michigan. So California had a Harvest of the Month program. Has a Harvest of the Month program, excuse me, Sue. Very successful, but there's a slight climate difference between California and Michigan. So we felt the need to do a little bit of tweaking on especially some of the fruits and vegetables that we featured and that were available and how it rolled out. So over the past few years, we have been able to roll out a multi-channel approach that has a direct ed leg, a social marketing leg that ties with the USDA core messages of they learn from watching you eat more fruits and vegetables, and they will too. And then many, many PSE strategies, coordinating with school food service, specifically the Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Program. So the Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Program requires nutrition ed but doesn't pay for it. Step in. Is nutrition education but doesn't pay for the snack, right? So when the two work together, you have a really robust program. School food service personnel have adopted that and really been very enthusiastic about it. And we have Jamie Rarig here, who's one of the staff at MFF who have been working so hard with the Michigan Department of Education. The partnerships with this program have been extremely profound. WIC, Fresh Fruit and Vegetable, Michigan Farmers Market Association, School Nutrition Association of Michigan, Food Bank Council of Michigan, Coordinated School Health Leads, retailers, Fair Food Network, lots of our regional SNAP Ed programs, as well as continuing to partner with California Department of Public Health and Public Health Institute, who is the outside evaluator for this intervention. So. Go to the Mountain Plains. Give you a little bit of a different channel. This is a really focused retail channel, Shop Healthy, Stock Healthy, Shop Healthy, which is a set of a shovel-ready intervention that a corner store can adopt. Some people like to now start trying to use the just add water term, but it's easy to use, easy to use. They have point of purchase prompts, online training, a toolkit, and their neighborhoods work with us and engage in this intervention. And it's prime for adoption by other local programs, other communities, and other interventions because everything is ready to go. They saw a 35% increase in healthy food inventory in the corner stores that adopted this, which I think is pretty amazing. In the Southwest, I want to feature Cooking with Kids. I think Cooking with Kids started as a fairly traditional direct ed program. I think we would all agree that cooking is an important skill if you're going to learn to eat healthfully. I did a stint teaching within a dietetics program, and many of the students that come to those programs now actually need to learn how to cook in college because they didn't get that at home. So it's a sign of the times. So cooking is an important part in that direct ed piece, but Cooking with Kids took their direct ed intervention and they just one-upped it. Those educators and the people working within the schools got engaged in food policy councils. They got engaged in community gardens, the school districts, the food service, and the lessons being taught in Cooking with Kids found their way into the recipes showed up at the farmers markets. They found their way into the school cafeteria. They were in the retail outlets. And so they just networked and linked all of those messages and all of that intervention throughout the community. Pretty impressive social marketing and training numbers for this program. And in the West, this one is a little bit different. The Empower program is about policy change. Child care center licensure fees evidently took a huge, they were increased a great deal in Arizona. I don't follow Arizona politics, but you know that's licensing fees are a hot topic in almost every state. So the licensed child care facilities it was going to hit them hard. And somebody got what I think was the brilliant idea to have a slate of 10 standards that, if adopted, your licensure fee would go down 50%. That's pretty powerful motivation. The partnerships that they have to help with that licensure reduction and so forth are broad, deep, and throughout their state. The standards include some SNAP ed, some non-SNAP ed, but 60 minutes of physical activity a day, sun safety, breastfeeding friendly environment, participate in CACFP, limit serving fruit juice to no more than 2 times a week, serve meals family style and do not use food as a reward, provide monthly oral health care education, and then staff members have to get 3 hours of training annually. Make Arizona's Smokers Helpline education materials available at all times and maintain a smoke-free campus. So really powerful things to get in place. And they have been quite successful in onboarding the adoption. 12% of their facilities have adopted all of the elements in both writing as well as full implementation, which includes a parent education component. So that's a different kind of a PSE than some of the others, but it's pretty powerful, I think, and they've been showing great success. So that's 7 regions around the world in 10 minutes, around the country in 10 minutes, but you'll be able to hear about all of these in the toolkit. There'll be links to each of them, and there's many more. I think we added 30-some interventions. Mm-hmm. Did we add 30-some more interventions, all evidence-based in PSE, in the toolkit? That should come out soon. So that said, I'm going to wrap up. Told you I could go quick. And hopefully I didn't rush everybody through that, but we'd be happy to talk more about any of these interventions or get you information on them.
Well, I'd like to thank our great panel for wrapping together what I'm not sure how many, I don't know, we're up to $1 billion, but the work that has occurred in SNAP-Ed over the last number of years and how it's shaping up to really make changes of the sort that can be taken to scale. So what we hope you walk away with is a feeling that there are proven evidence-based or practice-tested interventions, so you do not have to start from scratch. They're ones that harmonize with the other kinds of priorities and directions that the Centers for Disease Control and others have been advocating our partners in the private sector. And so this is a time, if you have any questions about or thoughts about what you heard today and what you think some of the challenges are and how we might be a stronger force for change. I just thinking in my career, when we started with SNAP-Ed, we didn't have the direction that you see now. And therefore, when Congress asked, have you all accomplished? How is this money being spent? We really were not able to characterize it very effectively. And we nearly lost the program in the mid, about, 2008, 9, 10, because we didn't have the results. So we don't want that to happen again. This program is authorized through the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill may or may not happen on schedule, but it should be somewhere around 2018. And what we want to do is enter that Farm Bill period with a really robust evidence base and partner base so that this program can grow to the point that it can meet the need of a much higher proportion of that 95 million people whose nutrition, physical activity, food insecurity problems are contributing to poor health, and the communities where those conditions are contributing to the larger issues of poor health. So I'm not trying to lecture, but are there any questions that people would like to ask? This is your chance to talk with Andy on some of the USDA direction. What do you think of what you heard with Kathleen about some of the measurements and communications, and with Marcy about how to communicate some of those examples and share with us some other areas that you think are important? Are there any comments? Yes. And I'm going to repeat your question so we could get it off mic.
So that was a wonderful presentation. My question for Mark, you referenced evidence-based strategies,
and I
wonder
if you could
simply say what your criteria is for determining when those strategies are evidence-based.
So do you
want to
repeat the question?
So the question, no? The question was about the criteria for reviewing the submissions for the evidence base. So there was a review rubric, and I've got some of the applications here. So I'll give you some of the sections of the proposal that people had to complete that were then scored for the what their evidence, the strength of the evidence base. And so people gave a summary, one paragraph summary, and then their objectives, but they had to highlight their evaluation results. They had to talk about the environmental, their evaluation framework according to actually some of the work in the Western Regional Framework that Andy's been working on, and tell us what of those 55, now 51, outcomes that they were achieving. So those were assuring that PSC. They had to talk about the types of different evaluation, both process and outcome and impact that they had conducted. They had to talk a little bit about their estimated cost and reach, which isn't exactly about PSD, but we wanted to make sure that they fit in line. They talked about where you could get the materials or the toolkits or the training pieces, and any publications that they may have or presentations that they may have given. So those were the scored elements of the proposals for review.
So you should find this out by Thanksgiving. It's a Thanksgiving gift to everybody. But this should be an annual cycle of submissions. And Marcy focused on the REAIM framework. And so we're really looking as well in the future for these submissions to include guidance, things like duty statements and budgets and schedules and so forth, to help others know what they would need to do if they wanted to implement this intervention effectively. Did I see another question? Diane.
Things that a program could do under the general title of Farm to School. As you mentioned, New York State and Farm to Preschool, and I actually was fielding a technical assistance request from the National Farm to School Network for other examples of Farm to Preschool activities that are in the Tampa. You have other examples, and I can tell them that we're working in other places.
Yeah, so what we the application.
Repeat the question.
The question was generally about examples of other farm to preschool that may be in play, and farm to school in general is a pretty broad concept, and how that was tightened down as it was accepted for entry into the toolkit. Did that summarize it pretty much? Okay. So first of all, the way that this farm to preschool program was submitted was pretty tightly defined in terms of the programming. They have it going on in 21 preschool sites, and they all have the program fidelity was pretty tight. So they have different things that they do in the different components. They have a really wonderful sort of training piece, both online. They have a conference, and it's those pieces are really tight within one state. And I guess that's the thing about doing it within your own, within one state or region, is that you can tighten those down. So they did a wonderful job with their submission, and that will all be available when the toolkit comes out to give you something to base on. We did not, this was simply from New York State. So if there's any other farm to preschools out there, you know, when I saw the logo, it looks a lot like the farm to school logo, the National Network logo. So if there's any other of them out there, I'm actually not aware of them.
So. Well, and that brings up a really good point, and that is that within the toolkit, within the framework, the evaluation framework, the interpretive guide, in some of the other indicators, we're trying to capitalize on some of the named initiatives, whether it's Smarter Lunchroom, which has standards, or Farm to School, or some of the other basically branded programs. We're looking to work with those leadership organizations to provide whatever assistance we can in taking those evidence-based initiatives to scale. And we don't want to invent any new wheels. What we want to do is try to get them help introduce them widely throughout the country. So we'll be learning a lot more as this goes on and trying to capture the magnitude of the farm-to-school activity in schools, in preschools, and so forth. Andy, did you want to add anything on this topic?
The Food and Nutrition Service also conducts the farm-to-school census, and I don't know if you're familiar with that, but the most recent round of census activities were released. And we are looking at the farm-to-school activities and how they do overlap with SNAP-Ed with respect to not only the framework, but just nutrition education in general. And while a lot of local educational agencies are focused on buying more foods locally, there are also the farm-to-school grants. And those are very small grants, but very important. And I think there's a lot of work that SNAP-Ed can help to do to partner with the farm-to-school recipients to achieve a larger goal by working together. So I don't think we have all the stories just yet, but I think there's also more of an emphasis now on farm to preschool as well as farm to summer. That's another priority topic.
I'm an advisory board of the National Farm to School Network, and I keep talking to them because the understanding among that network is very low. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one group that could use some collaboration.
Great, that's a great example.
And I'll just add, oh, there's another question. Go ahead.
So that's a really good question.
Repeat the question.
So the question is, the person asked about, in the CIRO region, the Southeast region, they're working with the Western Regional Framework as part of the learning community, and the question that comes up of required versus recommended, and also among the indicators, what would be the magic number? So one of the things we, the Food and Nutrition Service, we do look at required versus recommended, and what's required is what's in our authorizing in statute and law and regulation, and also everything that we do also comes about within our annual guidance and other administrative notices and so forth. In terms of evaluation in general, I mean, if you read through our regulation, the current one, or looking at the Act, there's nothing in that that says you must evaluate your program. So what we do say, though, is that there does need to be some degree of monitoring, so you do need to report data in the Education and Administrative Reporting System, but that, as you know, is not an evaluation system, that's the Administrative Reporting and Monitoring System. So what we're doing, everything with respect to evaluation is voluntary. And it's something that I think, as you can see from the last slide that I showed, it is, we are seeing a national movement in terms of having, number one, more evaluation, because we do want to demonstrate that we are doing programs that are effective, and number two, having a common set of indicators that we can use, because if all 50 states plus the territories are measuring something different, we really can't demonstrate the effectiveness of SNAP-Ed. So in terms of the number, what we actually originally did in 2014, we initially had 14 priority indicators, so it included the 7 that were there, as well as some of the long-term indicators at the individual level, plus 3 of the indicators at the sectors of influence level. One of the things that we found, in order to have broad-scale adoption, that 14 was actually too many, so we did scale that back to 7. And then in some cases, I know in the Southeast region, they are focused on looking at those 7 and potentially others that would be relevant as well. So I think that the key point is that we do want to have a small set of indicators that can be measured among every state, but the reason why we have over 50 indicators is so that way we provide that menu, so that way there is that flexibility that's responsive to the various types of programs, and if a state is working on an agricultural policy, there's an indicator that they could use for that.
Well, and I want to add, and we are sort of at time, I'm afraid, so I know the speakers can stay, but I just want to add that evaluation is really critical to continually improve what you're doing. And our goal is to get the job done and move on. We want to be able to develop programs that are so valuable that the people that are running them want to continue them with their own resources so that the SNAP-Ed money can be reinvested in other areas. We also, of course, need to keep in mind that we are a highly regulated program. It's kind of, in my understanding, it's different than the Centers for Disease Control programs, where we really have to show accountability, as Kathleen was talking about, for those outcomes and for the expenditure of the funds. So this is a work in progress. And it's only going to be that these data are useful to you, they're useful to your stakeholders, and they ultimately will show accountability and move the field forward. So I'd like to thank you all for spending this afternoon with us and for staying for the full time, and please join me in thanking our really great panel.